moving a village is more expensive than moving families. But when you move families, you're dispersing a community, you're dispersing a culture.
The cost of village relocation goes well beyond money. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Sitka Tribe will fund programs to help victims of assault.
They'll be providing all legal services related to recovery from domestic violence or assistance with domestic violence issues.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace in Alaska is now through Friday, December 15th. Enrollment assistance is available and it's free. Visit getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust.
The federal government has given an Italian company the go-ahead to explore for oil in Arctic waters this winter. It's the first oil exploration in Arctic federal waters since Shell abandoned its campaign in 2015. The company, Eni, aims to begin drilling next month. It will operate from an existing man-made gravel island called Spy Island. Spy Island is about 3 miles offshore in state waters west of Prudhoe Bay. The prospect is about 4 miles away from the island, so Eni plans to use extended reach drilling. According to the company, it will be the longest extended reach well in Alaska. Eni already produces about 20,000 barrels of oil per day from its facilities on state land. If the exploration in federal waters goes well, Eni thinks it could double production. Eni secured its leases before the Obama administration's decision to remove the Arctic Ocean from new oil and gas leasing for 5 years. The Trump administration is currently reconsidering that decision. The village of Newtok is disappearing as it loses land to a combination of thawing permafrost and coastal erosion. Newtok's 400 people have been trying to relocate for years, and for years the main obstacle has been the same, money. Now they're almost out of time. But as Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk reports, moving Newtok may take an act of Congress.
People say Newtok is dealing with erosion, but walk along the bank of the Ninglick River and you realize that word doesn't do it justice. Erosion sounds like something slow and steady wearing away at the land. What's happening here is crazier. Andrew John is Newtok's tribal administrator. He just got back to town last night, and first thing this morning, he came out here to the river with his measuring tape.
And I took some measurements and oh my goodness. I don't recognize any of this in just 5 weeks, you know?
That's because the land here is breaking off in giant chunks. The river is eating away at the permafrost beneath the tundra, undercutting the bank. During a big storm, whole blocks will break off, and the village can lose 10 or 20 feet at a time. The nearest house is about 40 feet from where we're standing right now. That means people are living just one or two big storms from the edge. And that's why pretty much everyone in Newtok agrees it's time to go. The village wants to relocate to a new site. It's a 20-minute boat ride upriver. Our destination?
We're going to heaven. That's what it feels like when we're there, you know? It's beautiful.
Heaven is Mukhtarvik, the new Newtok. It sits across the Ninglick River on Nelson Island, up on the side of a low mountain. In other words, it's not about to erode away. Newtok got this land in an exchange with the federal government over a decade ago. Since then, they've been trying to piece together enough funding to build homes and infrastructure. And over the years, they have managed to get some things built. As we approach the new site, we see what looks like a proto-village. We pull up to the landing, a little fast. From the water, you can see a handful of houses along a makeshift road. There's the foundation of what will someday, maybe, be the school. There's a row of heavy equipment waiting for the next construction season. We've arrived in heaven.
You crooked Parker, you.
As we walk up the hill, Andrew lays out Newtok's plans for this site. Roughly 100 homes, gravel roads instead of the sinking boardwalks at the current location, and running water, which the current village doesn't have.
something as simple as washing your face in the morning. You know what I mean? For warm water coming out of a faucet.
But to see the site's real pride and glory, we load into a four-wheeler and head out to the rock quarry. It was just finished this summer.
This time last year, all this was just a dream. Amen. Amen.
It's just a pit gouged out of the hillside, but this is the whole reason for moving to this site. It's built on rock, not spongy tundra. The river won't destroy it. From here, you can see for miles. Andrew explains why this view matters.
It's a part of who we are. This is our land. Upriver from the current village of Newtok are my ancestral roots.
Newtok is a pretty traditional Yupik village, one that relies on hunting and fishing. If the village can relocate to this site, close enough to the old one, they can continue that way of life. The problem is, it's not clear this new village will be ready before the old village is destroyed.
And Rachel, that's just a few years away. We don't have time.
Romy Cadiente is Newtok's relocation coordinator. The construction at the new site has been pieced together bit by bit over the last decade, but Newtok doesn't have anywhere near enough money to build everything they need. Housing, an airstrip, a school, a power plant. The Army Corps of Engineers estimates that price tag at $130 million. In a village where more than 40% of the community lives below the poverty line, that money will have to come from outside. But state and federal agencies have turned down Newtok's requests for disaster relief and other grants. If it's not possible to relocate together, families could simply scatter to Bethel or Anchorage. Romy says that's unacceptable.
We will do whatever we have to, as fast as we have to. We'll live in yurts, do anything, but we will not. Because essentially what you're really talking about is the preservation of the Yupik community, its traditional values, its identity.
This problem is bigger than Newtok.
We have these examples all across the country where you're having extreme weather events.
Joel Niemeyer heads the Denali Commission, the federal agency most closely involved in Newtok's relocation efforts.
As a country, we haven't yet resolved the question of how we want to respond to these.
He says Congress never envisioned relocating whole communities. There's no agency in charge of it. There's no pot of money to fund it. And yet, as climate change hits coastal communities around the country with flooding and erosion, it's a problem we will likely see more and more. He says Congress needs to make a decision. In these situations, is it U.S. policy to move whole communities? Or just move families? Or do nothing?
Obviously, moving a village is more expensive than moving families. But when you move families, you're dispersing a community, you're dispersing a tribe, you're dispersing a culture, and you'll lose that. So that is a very real policy decision Congress needs to grapple with.
Returning from the trip to the new site, the boat pulls up to Newtok's deteriorating shoreline. The waves roll over three old snow machines and the remains of a road, casualties of this fall's storms. Just steps away are the nearest houses. By this time next year, the water will reach those homes. Andrew John says he doesn't understand why this isn't enough to deserve help.
We're Americans too. And I, as a veteran, have fought in the forces in which safeguard our country and our way of life. And now I'm home, fighting for my people. In our way of life. I'm sorry.
It's a fight that may ultimately be won or lost nearly 4,000 miles from here, in Congress. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Newtok.
A Ketchikan-bound fuel barge loaded with 1 million gallons of diesel and gasoline that detached from its tug is now anchored with a protective boom around it while it awaits inspections by Canadian authorities. The Zytel Marine 277 barge detached from its tug Sunday while transiting through the Canadian portion of the Inside Passage. A second tug was able to reattach the 430-foot barge early Monday. Now it's anchored off Campbell Island near the community of Bella Bella, British Columbia. Fuel transport through the notoriously narrow Inside Passage is controversial among First Nations communities and environmentalists. A fuel barge ran aground in the same area after departing Ketchikan last year. It spilled about 29,000 gallons of diesel that closed a nearby clam fishery. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the new Tom Clancy book is out and the author lives in Alaska.
I hope they don't think I'm trying to imitate Tom Clancy because he's inimitable, but I hope that they enjoy seeing the characters continue on.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP. BP believes that Alaskans know their state best and invests in recruiting and hiring from their own backyard. 78% of the BP employees who work here live in Alaska. BP.com/Alaska. Alaska Humanities Forum grants support creative projects that share the stories of Alaska and explore what it means to be Alaskan. Get details and apply at akhf.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Humanities Forum.
A North Pole woman is dead, and her son is charged with her murder. Alaska State Troopers report that 59-year-old Vivian Osborne was found deceased, the victim of an apparent homicide at a North Pole home on Sunday afternoon. They say her son, 33-year-old Travis Reed of Fairbanks, was located in a locked bedroom at the residence. He was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Troopers say they were called to check on Osborne on Sunday. A family member reported not hearing from her since Thanksgiving and said that Reed may be at the home and possibly under the influence of methamphetamine. Operating a landfill off the road system in southeast Alaska has its own challenges. But what if the community is next to a national park that gets thousands of visitors each summer? That's the lay of the land in tiny Gustavus. As part of the Coast Alaska series Talking Trash, Jacob Resnick reports.
In this town, there's a joke that nothing's ever free. Because even if someone gives you something, you'll eventually have to pay to throw it away or even recycle it at the city-run landfill.
I marvel at it, you know, that someone will pay 60 cents a pound to recycle their TV.
Paul Berry is the main architect of the city's disposal and recycling center. We'll hear more from him in a minute. Because one of the main challenges here comes from Glacier Bay National Park. 500,000 people visit the park each year, most by cruise ship. But those flying or ferrying in leave behind what they don't want or need. For decades, the National Park Service had its own dump, but then the inevitable happened. Mark Ortega is the park's utilities supervisor.
Well, basically, we ran out of room footprint-wise.
The Park Service turned to the city of Gustavus. It's small, with less than 500 year-round residents. The Park Service pays the city to take its waste, but first, it's meticulously sorted. That's National Park maintenance worker Dan Grivois' job.
So we typically get around anywhere from 100 to 200 pounds of trash every day. You know, my job is basically to get the biggest diversion rate out of that as I can.
To cut down on space and expense, the park burns its waste in a towering incinerator.
There we go.
Internal temperatures reach a biblical 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit. The remaining white ash is delivered to the city's disposal and recycling center. Manager Paul Berry is proud of the operation.
Food waste composting and 60 to 70% of your material coming in that building being recycled in one way or another. I mean, that's Seattle and San Francisco standards. It's not something you typically see in rural Alaska.
There are more than a dozen bins for sorting recycling. Each number of plastic, cardboard, appliances, metals, even dirty diapers have their place. Yet aside from the faint smell of mulch from the compost heap, there's almost no odor.
You have a food waste composting operation and an active landfill, and there are no resident seagulls, there are no resident ravens. We haven't had a bear inside the facility since 2001, and that was the year we put up the electric fence.
It wasn't always like this. Berry recalls his first visit in the early 1980s. It was a different scene. Imagine a shallow pit filled with household waste and diesel fuel.
And if it wasn't already burning or smoldering, you would light it and leave. And, you know, there was some salvage, because I remember, like, I seen a TV set there. But it was pretty bad. And my impression at that time was that, you know, this is yuck.
The state owned it back then, but when the federal EPA tightened up landfill regulations, the community had to clean up its act. The city incorporated in 2004, and one of the first things it did was take over the dump. The city soon realized that if things didn't change, the landfill would fill up in a few years, and there aren't exactly other sites.
You see, Gustavus, though, is surrounded by National Park wilderness, so you can't go out of town like you usually do in a lot of communities and start a new facility on state land somewhere. It just ain't there.
Gustavus is remote. It only got state ferry service in 2010, yet it gets about 20,000 annual visitors who stay at lodges and step off tour boats. To stay on top of this influx, it aggressively recycles. About 40 tons are shipped annually to Seattle. It raises as much money from the recycling as it can. Still, that's only 4% of the operation's income. Because back to the joke, everything costs money to dump or recycle here. Well, almost everything. They'll take aluminum cans. But what most people in the country drop off for free, such as plastic water bottles and cardboard, in Gustavus, they're charged 19 cents a pound, even more if it's unsorted.
We are funding it by charging people to recycle, which strikes some people as like, what?
And that's what Barry says is the secret to Gustavus' success, community buy-in. So how could other places replicate this? Barry says it takes three things.
You have to have an individual who's willing to do it.
He's talking about himself.
You have to have a small group of people with influence in the community to support that individual.
That would be Gustavus's grassroots landfill committee that began organizing in the 1990s.
And then finally, you have to have a community who's willing to do it.
Despite the high recycling rate, this landfill will likely be out of space in 4 to 8 years. With few choices for a new site and little room to expand, Gustavus will probably start barging its solid waste to a landfill in the lower 48. In Gustavus, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
ACPE's education loan refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
The Sitka Tribe of Alaska has landed more than $2 million in federal grant money to aid victims of domestic violence. The money is being awarded in three separate grants and will create five new positions to support women and children in Sitka. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
The first grant puts $600,000 toward facility improvements at Sitkins Against Family Violence, which provides shelter for domestic violence victims. The money comes from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Grant Administrator Rachel Henderson says Sitka Tribe works with SAFE often, and this grant provides direct support for the shelter and the people it serves.
65% of the people that use the SAFE shelter are Alaska Natives, so we thought it was important in that regard to help tribal citizens. And also most of the people that go there either have low or moderate income, so it's just helpful to the community in general that SAFE has a expanded and renovated facility.
The SAFE shelter was built in the 1960s. SAFE bought the building in 1995 and made some changes, but no large renovations to the floor plan. With this money, SAFE will expand the facility's square footage and renovate the existing living space. Currently, SAFE has space for 24 women and children.
It's going to add an area for animals so that people who are coming to the shelter can bring their animals with them. It's going to expand 8 bedrooms so that they can have 4 family-sized bedrooms and then 4 smaller bedrooms. It's going to improve the bathrooms so that one of the bathrooms is more handicapped accessible, and then one of the bedrooms will also be more handicapped accessible.
STA also received 2 grants from the U.S. Department of Justice Office on Violence Against Women. The first, for just over $899,000, will be used to fund 3 positions for the next 3 years. An advocate for victim services at SAFE, a transitional housing program manager at STA, and a domestic violence investigator at the Sitka Police Department. All 3 positions will share a common goal of aiding victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. Melanie Board, Social Services Director for Sitka Tribe of Alaska, says there was a crucial need to work with Sitka Police and SAFE to address the needs of women in the community from multiple angles.
There's been a desperate need for transitional housing for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault.
And there's definitely a need for a more effective approach to investigating crimes of domestic violence. And also because of the diminished shelter funding, there's also a need for enhanced victim services.
The second DOJ grant, the Legal Assistance for Victims Grant, allocates $599,000 over the next 3 years to fund two positions. Naomi Palisari, tribal attorney for STA, says the money will first pay for a full-time attorney who will work out of Sitka Tribe offices.
They will see clients, they will screen them for eligibility, they will represent them in court, they will draw up paperwork, they'll be providing all legal services related to recovery from domestic violence or assistance with domestic violence issues.
Sitka Tribe is now advertising for a family law attorney to fill that position. All other grant-funded positions took effect on October 1st. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
Tom Clancy, the author, died in 2013, but Tom Clancy, the fiction series powerhouse, is very much alive and well. The continuation of Clancy's thrillers are now in the capable hands of an Alaskan author, Eagle River resident Mark Cameron, a best-selling author in his own right. Cameron has just released his first Clancy book. Power and Empire features Clancy characters President Jack Ryan and his son, Jack Ryan Jr., who works for a secret intelligence agency. Cameron is a retired federal marshal. He says years ago, when he was in law enforcement, he started gathering ideas for his novels.
I just made a lot of notes and kept, being observant along the way. And when I got on with the Marshal Service, I started in my spare time, spent a lot of time traveling and in hotel rooms, and I just decided I was not going to turn on the TV and just started writing and filling up notebooks, and eventually was fortunate enough to get published.
So a year ago, and this sort of sounds like a line from a novel, you're on a beach, you get a phone call. Tell us what happened with that phone call.
So my wife and I were down in Florida researching for a series that I write, and we had taken a little break and we were on the beach. We do a lot of chatting and plotting together and, talking about plots for future books. And I got a phone call, and it was from my literary agent, who she's also been my agent for about 15 years. And she said, Mark, I just want to let you know that the editors from Putnam have called and they want you to write the next Tom Clancy Jack Ryan book. As a longtime Tom Clancy fan, I did what any writer would do and basically collapsed on the beach and got a bad headache. But
well, Mark, I'm reading the book now. It's incredibly fast-paced, and it's enormous, nearly 600 pages. Mm. Power and Empire features President Jack Ryan and his son, Jack Ryan Jr. Did you have the leeway to say, I'm going to write the book with these characters, or is it more of a story collaboration between you and the Clancy editors? How does that work?
I have a tremendous amount of leeway, but it is collaboration. And Tom Colgan, the editor that I work with at Putnam, he's been Clancy editor for a number of years, way back with Clancy. We bounce ideas off each other, but they give me a tremendous amount of leeway. Of course, the book has to be about Jack Ryan. He is the premier character. But to the extent that I bring in those other characters besides Jack Ryan, President Ryan and Jack Ryan Jr., that's really left up to me and what's called for in the plot.
The book involves international tensions between the U.S. and China, and also has subplots involving human trafficking. Where did you go to do research for? I know that you're big on location researching, mm-hmm. and travel all over the world. Mm-hmm. Where did you go to research Power and Empire?
Well, so my wife and I went to Buenos Aires and spent a couple of weeks there doing some research. Went to Japan. And then a lot of it takes place in Texas, where I grew up, the human trafficking side of things. Yeah, Tom Clancy was a stickler for that sort of detail, and it's often said that if he wrote about a particular rock in Central Park, he wanted a reader to be able to go to Central Park and find that rock. And so when I write about the Recoleta Cemetery, for instance, in a big chase and surveillance scene through Recoleta Cemetery in Buenos Aires, where there's a lot of above-ground crypts, and you can look through little windows and see the coffins and, you know, pictures of the deceased. And it's just a labyrinth of these tiny little 10x8 crypts. And I wanted people to go there and be able to walk through the area where the pursuit and the surveillance occurred.
So often when I have said to friends and colleagues, hey, I know the guy that's writing the next Tom Clancy book. He lives in Eagle River. And they say, well, what do you mean he's writing Tom Clancy books? Where's Tom Clancy? How often do you get that question from people that Tom Clancy is deceased? Are they surprised?
Yeah, pretty much all the time, anytime it comes up. And I've read some of the other reviews of friends that wrote Tom Clancy, and some people are just angry that the franchise is carried on. That's their business. But I really think that I personally, before I ever had this gig, really enjoyed the being able to see the characters continue and not die with Tom Clancy. And so that's what I say when people talk about that I hope that when people pick it up, they don't think I'm trying to imitate Tom Clancy, because he's inimitable. But I hope that they enjoy seeing the characters continue on.
I know that you're supposedly retired from law enforcement, although I wonder about that, because you clearly have a lot of contacts still within law enforcement, both on the state and federal side. Is Tom Clancy really dead, or is he in hiding with Elvis somewhere, and you're just not telling us?
No, as far as I know, he's passed away. I can't confirm or deny.
Mark Cameron is the new author of the Tom Clancy political thriller series. The book, Power and Empire, was released today. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Rachel Waldholtz in Newtok, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Catherine Rose in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC. If you're a single person who makes less than $60,240 per year, you're eligible for federal tax credits to help pay health insurance premium costs. If you need health insurance for 2018, there's a limited window to act. Open enrollment for 2018 plans is from November 1st through December 15th of 2017. If you don't have coverage, it could be financially devastating. Sign up at healthcare.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.